The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
You're going to hear a conversation between an agent and Scott. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. Now listen to the tape and answer the questions.
Howdy, what can I do for you?
I'm here to ship some things back to China.
Okay, we can do that. Shipping things back, eh? Have you lived there before?
Yeah, I lived there for 3 years and came back 2 years ago. Now I'm going back to start my own business.
Really? Did you ship things with us last time?
No, I used a Chinese shipping agency.
Well, I'll just let you know that rates have changed recently. So I don't know if they'll be comparable to what you paid before.
It doesn't matter to me. My company's paying for it.
Aha. Then it's nothing off your skin, right? Okay. I'll need your name and where you need to go to pick up the items to be shipped.
My name is Scott Linder, L-I-N-D-E-R, and I live in upstate New York, Saratoga Springs.
Oh, sure. I know that place. I go to the races there. Great town. What's the zip there again?
770425. And the street address is 412 West Lake Road.
770425 West Lake, got it. And how big of a container are you going to be looking for?
Well, I didn't have a container last time, and I don't think I'll need one this time. I think that I'll have about 6 cubic meters.
We can get a subsection of a container then.
How big is that?
It's 2 meters wide and 3 meters long.
2 meters high, right?
Yes, sir.
Now look at questions 6 to 10. As the talk continues, answer questions 6 to 10.
And for customs, I need to know what sort of items will you be shipping?
Mostly furniture. But we'll also have quite a few boxes of books too.
Any clothing?
Nope. But we'll have some bicycles and wood that we use for a loft bed.
Be careful with those bicycles. I hear bicycle theft is a big problem in China.
Not if you know how to secure your bikes and where to store them.
Well, good luck. How valuable do you want me to list the entire shipment as being?
Let's say about $3,500.
Great. Now you'll also have to go over to the customs department to check with them about shipping the wood over to China. I know there are concerns about termites, bugs, etc.
No problem. It's the same wood I brought over from China last time.
Then you should be okay. It's just a formality. And last of all, where would you like the shipment to be delivered?
Well, I will live in Beijing, but let's ship it to Tianjin. My company will pick it up there.
That's all right then. Have a nice trip.
Thanks for your help.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part 2.
Part 2.
You will hear someone talking about travelling around New Zealand. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen and answer questions 11 to 15.
When thinking about beautiful countryside or stunning views, it has long been accepted that Australia and New Zealand have few equals. What is perhaps slightly less well known is what these countries can offer to the avid train enthusiast. Both countries have railways which pass through breathtaking scenery in the utmost of comfort. In New Zealand, you can travel from the country's biggest city, Auckland, to where a third of the population lives, its capital, Wellington, on the longest passenger rail service in the country, the Overlander. Crossing 681 kilometres, the train winds through the lush farmland of the Waikato and up the Rarumu Spiral onto an amazing volcanic plateau surrounded by native bush. On a clear day, you will be able to see three of New Zealand's most famous volcanoes, Mount Ruapehu, Mount Narahoe, and Mount Tongariro. The whole journey can be completed in 11 hours, but for those keen to see a little more of the country, the trip can be extended over 3 or 4 days. This gives travellers the opportunity of seeing the famous Waitomo Caves, relaxing in the mud pools of Rotorua, or skydiving over Lake Taupo. Moving on to the South Island, you can take the Transalpine through the Southern Alps, travelling from the South Pacific Ocean to the Tasman Sea. Climbing from Christchurch right into the Alps, this 223-kilometre trip is particularly impressive as the train passes through 16 tunnels before descending to Greymouth at the end of the line. Taking only 5 hours, this is a relatively short trip, but it is worth noting that this journey has been listed as the 6th most scenic rail route in the world. For those that are not so keen on mountains, the South Island has a second option, the Transcoastal. With the sea on one side and the mountains on the other, it again shows some of the best scenery New Zealand has to offer. Also taking 5 hours, one of the highlights of this journey is the opportunities for whale watching. The fortunate few that see whales are well rewarded, but there are more common sights which are just as enjoyable, such as penguins and seals.
Before you hear the rest of the recording, you have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 16 to 20.
Although these three train journeys are undeniably breathtaking, some travellers prefer the longer journeys on offer in Australia. The Indian Pacific, for example, which travels from Sydney through to Perth and has been dubbed the adventure that spans Australia. With 3 nights on board, the train takes in the Blue Mountains and the Nullarbor Plains, and, as the name implies, the Indian Pacific shows you two oceans. This train journey holds 2 world records. Covering 4,352 kilometres, it is one of the world's longest train journeys. It also travels the world's longest straight stretch of railway track, 478 kilometres. For those who find these distances a little daunting, passengers can stretch their legs at a number of different stops, such as Kalgoorlie, famous for gold, and Broken Hill, first founded as a silver mine. If 3 days on board a train seems a little excessive, there are alternatives. The Ghan, for example, which travels from Adelaide in the south to Alice Springs in the centre of the continent, taking 20 hours. Passing through Crystal Brook, Port Augusta and Woomera, this journey gives an indication of what life was like for the earlier settlers as they discovered the country. Along the way, you can also see the Iron Man sculpture, which was constructed by railway workers to commemorate the 1 millionth concrete sleeper laid during the construction of the line. Finally, just a quick word about the Overland, which runs between Melbourne and Adelaide. As the first train to travel between the capitals of two states, It is a historic as well as relaxing way to travel, and is famous for being the oldest long-distance train journey on the continent. With so many memorable journeys to choose from, the only problem you will have is knowing which one to do first.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part three.
Part three.
You'll hear a lecturer talking to students about America in the 1960s. You have some time to look at questions 21 to 26. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 26.
We begin our examination of America in the 1960s with the usual caution. There is no sense in trying to understand any decade without looking at what came before. Those of you who still have outstanding coursework on the 1950s would do well to complete it now, if for no other reason than it will help make sense of the next series of lectures. But we must press on, and I'd like to begin my talk about the 60s with a reference to one of those things that came before, the post-war baby boom. With the end of the Second World War in 1945, there began in the USA an era of perceived prosperity and security. In short, people started to feel that the world was a much better and safer place to bring up children. So, at the start of the 60s, all those children born in the baby boom, 70 million in the U.S. alone, were teenagers. As the 60s progressed, and as this large number of people approached adulthood, there was a noticeable shift in the balance of power, and young people began to have a voice in ways that were not considered possible in the more conservative atmosphere of the preceding decade. Things were moving forward at a rapid pace. The literature of the time brought out all the taboos. Everything was covered, such as race in, for example, the book To Kill a Mockingbird. The role of women changed, and equality for women, well, let's just say that once certain books were published, women were no longer going to be satisfied with their roles as devoted wives and mothers. Through literature alone, the whole fabric of society was challenged, and by the end of the 60s, things would never again be as they had pretty much been for the preceding 40 years. It was a decade of protest, civil rights protests, feminism, the rights of minorities, the Vietnam War. All these causes led to peaceful and not so peaceful protests on college campuses and elsewhere. People had been given freedom of speech and they were going to use it. The crime rate rose to 9 times what it was in the 50s. As respect for the old order faded away. But it was also a time of great development. In medicine, the 60s saw the first heart transplant. In technology and the space race, where we saw the first American in orbit and lasers being invented at the start of the decade, and the first man on the moon, and the first primitive internet at the end.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 27 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 27 to 30.
None of this, good or bad, might have happened if things in 1962 had gone slightly differently. On October 16th, President John F. Kennedy met with his closest advisors at the White House. They had obtained photographic evidence showing that Cuba was building or installing nuclear weapons. It was widely believed that Cuba was preparing to fire these weapons at cities in the USA. Kennedy was faced with three choices: to try to resolve the crisis diplomatically by negotiating with Cuba and the Soviet Union, to take action to block the delivery of more weapons into Cuba, or to attack Cuba, destroying their weapons. Believing that the first option would end in failure and that the third option would lead to war, it was the second option that Kennedy chose. In doing so, he succeeded in preventing the buildup of more missiles. The Soviet Union then withdrew the weapons from Cuba. Most historians agree that if Kennedy had acted differently, the episode would have led to a full-scale nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union. Millions would have died, and the world would have been changed beyond recognition.
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part four.
Part four.
In this section, you'll hear an interview on IQ tests.
First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Mrs. Kellerman, a specialist in child psychology, is interviewed by Bridget.
Mrs. Kellerman, why is it that some children perform much better than others at school? Obviously, it can't be denied that certain children are brighter than others, but it's not as simple as that. A lot of emphasis is placed on intelligence measured by tests, so-called IQ tests, which only measure certain types of intelligence, such as basically linguistic and numerical skills, or reading and mathematics, to put it plainly, which is unfortunate because some children are bound to suffer. A good example was a friend of mine's son who was kept out of the top class at school because of his average IQ. That's around 100. His father, though he had no idea his son was going to be an architect, always said he was a clever child. Apparently, he was able to picture things in his mind and draw accurately at a very early age. The point is that his university life might not have been so difficult if his ability had been recognized sooner. What you're saying, then, is that some children have abilities that are not easy to measure, that aren't appreciated by many schools.
Precisely. And if these schools are not spotted sufficiently early, they cannot be developed. That's why, in my view, there are so many unhappy adults in the world. They are not doing the things they are best at.
What are those other kinds of intelligence? How can we recognize them in our children?
Well, take musical talent. Many children never get the chance to learn to play an instrument, but while they might not become great artists or composers, they may get a lot of pleasure and satisfaction. Musically gifted children are fascinated by all kinds of sounds, car horns, animal noises, and so on, and they can easily recognize tunes and sing them in key.
How can a parent encourage them?
Sing to them and teach them new songs. Buy a piano or even a cheap instrument, such as a recorder. If you can afford it, send them to music lessons as soon as possible. Play recordings of different instruments to them.
What about a child who is good at sport? Could that be described as a form of intelligence?
Most certainly. We psychologists call it motor or bodily intelligence. These children move gracefully and handle objects skillfully. A child who finds it easy to take things apart and use various tools may well become an engineer with the right encouragement. We should give them models to make and take them to science museums. However, unless these children are also good with words and numbers, they will probably not do well in school examinations.
Is there anything a parent can do to help in this case?
Yes, it may be worth spending money on private lessons, but, you know, hardly anyone is good at everything. In my opinion, a child should be judged on his individual talents. After all, being happy in life is putting your skills to good use, no matter what they are.
That is the end of part 4.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.